My guest today, Rania Masri, described herself as a human rights activist. She is that and much more. She earned her PhD in forestry from North Carolina State in 2001, and from 2005 until this year, she was an assistant professor of environmental science at Balamand University in Lebanon, and since 2011 had chaired the department. Next month, she'll assume the post of associate director of the Asfari Institute for Civil Society and Citizenship at the American University of Beirut. If I tell you what she has accomplished before and after gaining her doctorate in terms of writing, organizing, and social and environmental activism, we wouldn't have time for our interview. I met her in San Francisco sometime in the 90s, where she was speaking on either Iraq or Palestine, and interviewed her for KPU, where I hosted a program much like this one, and she has been my guest on Takes on the World in 2007, 2008, and 2009. Well, Rania, you've obviously been away from our airwaves too long. Welcome back to Takes on the World.
Pleasure to be with you all, Jeff.
I was struck, as you were, by the declaration by President Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor, Tony Blinken, that the capture of an Israeli officer by Hamas fighters in Gaza was barbaric, while the murder of 1,800 Gazans and the destruction of much of Gaza by the fourth most powerful army in the world, armed by the United States, was not. Please share with our listeners your own thoughts on that.
Well, you know, if we add to that President Obama's recent statement...
Could you speak up a little bit, dear?
Yes, I'm sorry. I said if we add to that President Obama's recent statement, where he spoke about, and I'm quoting here, when we have the unique capabilities to help avert a massacre, then I believe the United States of America cannot turn a blind eye. So we see both with his definition of the word barbaric and with how he defines a massacre... There seems to be lives of certain people that he completely discounts. So just as we have 1,900 Palestinians, that not only does he not consider their deaths to be barbaric, but he also funds them. He also supports their killing financially and diplomatically. And I say diplomatically because the United States was the only country in the United Nations to veto an investigation by the Human Rights Commission to look into war crimes committed by the Israeli government in this past month. So we see very clearly that we have President Obama, his administration, most definitely inclusive of Hillary Clinton, who have completely dismissed the lives of Palestinians, have completely supported their murder, have disregarded them. Hillary Clinton has taken it to an even greater level, you know, more grotesque than President Obama, because she claims that Hamas is, quote, stage managing. If we can understand that, she's claiming that Hamas, quote, stage manages the conflict to engender sympathy. This is a direct quote. So in other words, we have Hillary Clinton saying here that it is the Palestinians themselves that kill their children or allow the killing of their children, particularly to gain international sympathy. I mean, that takes dehumanization and racism to a whole other level than President Obama, but nevertheless, they are working together very, very strongly here to dismiss Palestinian lives, to support their murder, all the while forgiving and condoning Israeli apartheid.
Well, we can't forget Congress. I mentioned, besides the unanimous votes that Israel received from both houses of Congress, including from liberal Democrats or independent Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Congressman from New York, Steve Israel, the head of the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee, flew over this month with a group of other congressmen to get his marching orders from Netanyahu, who's very concerned that the Palestinians may go to the International Criminal Court. So what is your sense of Congress's role in this crime cover-up?
Well, we did have eight members of the House of Representatives that voted against giving $225 million to this Iron Dome for the Israeli military, and four of them are Democrats, four of them are Republicans, which is very interesting. But when we look at Congress, I think it's critical that we put this into context and we recognize that in this country, we do not have a democracy. And it's not myself that's saying this. Noam Chomsky has been saying this for a while, that we live in a plutocracy. We have statements and analysts coming out of Yale University and others that are saying, even on issues where the vast majority of Americans believe one way, Congress votes another way. And the prime example up here is gun control and gun reform in this country. So the question becomes, How can we effectively organize in the United States, given that we do not live in a democracy, but rather we live in a plutocracy? Yes, we don't live in a dictatorship, but nor do we live in a democracy where it's simply that the majority get to determine public policy.
Arguably, most Americans have kind of tuned out in the sense that they feel that they have any influence over what their members of Congress do. This is the month where they're visiting in their home districts. And I had contacted our own local member of Congress and asked him if he had any second thoughts about voting to support Israel in Gaza. And what he essentially wrote back to me was the Israel line. And there doesn't seem to be any arena or any place in Congress where the public can have any input because, well, it's like health insurance or so many other issues. Members of Congress appear to be lawyers representing corporate interests. In this case, Israel would be a corporation, which they represent, like the automobile companies, like the arms, industry, and so on. How do we go about dealing with organizing a campaign, a people's campaign, in changing this?
Well, I think we need to examine history of public protest and of uprisings here in the United States. And we can look at the example of South Africa. We can look at other examples where we have impacted policy here. And it happens through two ways. One, we have to create a large enough movement, that cannot be disregarded. I mean, even in dictatorships, dictators do pay a mind to public opinion once public opinion gets to be so large that it cannot be ignored. So we need to be traveling on that route. And one critical way to be doing that, which is not only for strategic reasons, but also for ethical reasons, because it is the same struggle, is all of us who are committed to liberation in Palestine need to be committed to liberation against racism here in this country. That means that the Palestinian struggle is part and parcel of the African-American liberation struggle. I mean, it's been 2 days, and we've had another two killings by policemen against unarmed black men. The latest one happened today in Los Angeles, where a man was shot in the back while lying down. I mean, this is happening so regularly that it's almost every 36 hours in this country we have another unarmed black man that is killed. So we have to be connecting these struggles. It is the same struggle. It's a combined struggle against racism. We connect it on ethical grounds, we connect it on liberation grounds, and we also connect it on strategic grounds, because it is together that we can win the fight. The second aspect that we look into is we need to be looking at this economically. It is when companies in this country realize that making business with Israel is no longer good business for the company that we will have an added leeway to change public policy in this country. This is what worked against apartheid South Africa. This was the breaking point for the U.S. government. We remember the U.S. government was the last government to speak out against apartheid South Africa. And this is one of the key ways that we do it, which is, again, it is essential for us all to vehemently support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and to put pressure on local and national and international companies to have them divest from the state of Israel and for them to know that if they work with apartheid, they will lose our business.
Well, this program, the BDS program, has certainly made great strides in Europe. And a month or so ago, the Presbyterian, after a very long number of years, decided by a very close vote to divest from three American companies, large American companies, Caterpillar, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard, that were heavily involved in maintaining the occupation of the West Bank. And this caused great concern with the Jewish establishment. And as a matter of fact, in Israel, they have been very concerned about it. There's one company, there's one organization in this country called the Israeli Action Network, headed by Jerry Palast, the sister of investigative reporter Greg Palast, whose sole job is to undermine the BDS movement in this country. Most people aren't aware of this. This doesn't get much publicity in the paper, but it's a really good point you make. Also, the points about linking struggles. During the 60s, during the Vietnam War, the black liberation struggle and the anti-Vietnam War movement were linked together. And later, the Central American, anti-Central American U.S. intervention movements were linked together. So it's a really important point that you make. Unfortunately, the Congressional Black Caucus seems to be as much in the Israel lobby's pocket as they were during the apartheid movement, when they did not take any stand against Israel selling arms to South Africa. So we have a big job ahead of us.
Yes, we do. Most definitely we do.
You know, I want to get to your thoughts about what's going to happen, what's going on now in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the third day of a ceasefire, which seems to be holding, and there's been discussion, mentioned in the paper this morning, of a potential international conference in which Europe, Israel, of course, the Palestine Authority, Saudi Arabia would be involved. And the idea is essentially to demilitarize Gaza and put the Palestinian Authority back in control of the West Bank. But given the Palestinian Authority's collaboration with the Israeli government in terms of suppressing Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, is this a likelihood? Apart from being desirable, is this a likelihood of occurring after what we've seen in Gaza?
Well, whether it's a likelihood or whether it's desirable are two separate things. We have 5 hours right now at the time of this interview. We have 5 hours remaining for the ceasefire. So if there is not an agreement reached within 5 hours, then the bombardment and the military assault against Gaza will resume. When we look at what is being proposed, I mean, the Israeli offer is basically one of divide and conquer. They want to strengthen Mahmoud Abbas, who is their man within the Palestinian Authority. They want to weaken the Palestinian resistance. They are specifically demanding the disarmament of Hamas, which they have no legitimacy to make that demand. They have placed conditions on the lifting of the blockade, which would basically involve easing the blockade and not lifting the blockade. They have rejected any discussion of a seaport or an airport. Rather, they have combined this presentation that Israeli security has to be on equal stance with economic growth in Gaza, which basically means that anything that the Israelis deem to be detrimental to their, quote, security would not be allowed within Gaza, which could involve most anything. Those of us who were working on the Iraq sanctions movement know very well how broad these so-called dual-use items are. So the Israeli offer is a continual rejection of international law, whereas what the Palestinians are asking is basically even a partial implementation of international law and not a full implementation. They are basically asking for the lifting of the siege, which is illegal, the opening of the border crossings, which has to happen. They're asking for the establishment of a seaport or an airport, and they're willing to have the seaport and the airport be under United Nations supervision, so they're willing to even relinquish a bit of their sovereignty. They're asking for the implementation of the Oslo Accords back in 1993, when it was agreed upon that the fishing zone for fishermen in Gaza would extend beyond 10 nautical miles, whereas right now, the Israeli Navy barely even allows Palestinian fishermen to fish within 1 nautical mile. So they're asking for very, very basic things. But however, is it likely that what the Palestinians are demanding, which is their legitimate right, is it likely that it will be agreed upon? And I don't think so, because when we look at who's with who, we have the Israelis right now that are supported not just by the United States, but also by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, and by certain elements within the Palestinian Authority. We have Hamas and the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinians in Gaza basically supported by no strong outside power. They're supported by the Syrian government, but we know the strength of the Syrian government right now, so it's almost a mute defense. So they're alone in these negotiations, supported only by the hundreds of thousands of people that are protesting around the world and are standing with the Palestinians. But thus far, our strength does not translate into strong governmental power. So at this stage, it is looking extremely unlikely that we will resolve this crisis in a positive manner. And Palestinian after Palestinian within Gaza continue to say the same thing, that we do not want the resumption of the ceasefire if it will mean not lifting the sanctions. They are being very, very clear. I mean, you had one individual who's already lost 18 members of his family. 18 members of his family have been killed, and he said, and I quote, "Without lifting the siege, I do not welcome any ceasefire, even if all my family end up killed." And that's because the siege is itself another form of murder. It is itself a form of economic destruction, educational destruction, spiritual destruction, a complete prison that has been placed upon Palestinians. But am I hopeful at this hour? No, unfortunately, I am not.
Well, I know that I've mentioned on my program before, if there's one thing that characterizes Israel's relationship and treatment of the Palestinians, as well as the Lebanese when they were in Lebanon, is sadism. And there was one Israeli official who once publicly said that we'll put the Palestinians in Gaza on a diet.
Yes.
They treat the Palestinians, well, much like the American politicians do, as if they're subhuman. And as long as they're able to get away with it, they'll continue doing that. I had my own experiences in Lebanon when Israel was occupying Lebanon, seeing how they treated Lebanese civilians, some of whom actually in the beginning had welcomed Israel's 1982 invasion because they didn't want the struggle being fought on their territory. But Israel's anti-Arab racism is so deeply inculcated in their society that the Israeli soldiers treated the Lebanese civilians just like they treated the Palestinians. And what came out of that was Hezbollah. Now, they want Hezbollah to disarm, but if Hezbollah disarmed, Israel would just go all over Lebanon without the way they've actually treated West Bank and Gaza.
It is impossible right now for Hezbollah to be armed, and if we're going to compare it with the Palestinian resistance, Hezbollah remains supported by Iran and remains supported by Syria and by half the Lebanese population, if not more. And we have open borders in Lebanon where Hezbollah can continue to get its support, versus in Gaza, it's nothing at all like that. And between 1982 and now, 2014, the level of anti-Arab racism that you're talking about has only escalated within Israel, where we have 95% of the Israeli population now supporting the bombardment of Gaza. You have open calls in Israeli papers, open calls for ethnic cleansing and genocide, using the words of genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. So the level of fascism within Israel has dramatically risen. The level of racism within Israel has dramatically risen.
Well, actually, Israel is without a doubt, and arguably from the statements of their politicians, not to mention journalists and ex-politicians, but current politicians, the most right-wing state ever elected by in what is called a democracy, because they were elected and have been re-elected by the majority of Israeli people, the 85% or 80% whom are Jewish. And it's interesting, there are a number of American supporters of Israel, as well as Israelis, who have said, well, Hamas was elected by the people of Gaza, therefore the people of Gaza are legitimate targets.
Yeah.
Whereas if you would say that about the people of Israel having elected one war criminal after another, Sharon, Netanyahu, Begin, so on, people would be up in arms, but they can make these statements. And they're published in the Israeli papers, not so much in the American papers, because they don't want the American people to know the extent of racism and sadism and fascism that currently exists in Israel, which you mentioned. How do we break into that, break that silence in this country, let people know exactly what America is supporting?
Well, you know, the beauty of arrogant fascist leaders is they become very open in what they want. And so while we have Israeli leaders in the United States talking about they have empathy for both sides and the so-called peace that they claim to believe in, if we read Haaretz, if we read the Times of Israel, if we just read Israeli papers and they're published in English, they're accessible to all, we have here statements made very, very clearly by Israeli leaders, by Israeli journalists, by Israeli academics that openly call for ethnic cleansing, genocide, mass transfer, sterilization of people of color, so on and so forth. It doesn't take much work on our part to simply take their statements and distribute them here and make people aware that this is actually what the vast majority of the Israeli society is asking for. So much so that there is a movement within Israel, extraordinarily small, but there is a movement within Israel called Boycott from Within. And this is a group of people that are asking for Israel to be boycotted to liberate Israel from its own fascism and racism and apartheid. And these are Israelis. These are Israelis reaching out to the international community and saying, please boycott us because we need your support to dismantle this institutionalized apartheid and racism and fascism. And, you know, I've been saying the word apartheid, but I want to refer to what Noam Chomsky said recently, when he said that Israel is not an apartheid state because it is much worse than apartheid South Africa, much worse than apartheid South Africa. Because in apartheid South Africa, the ones that supported apartheid actually wanted the black South Africans to remain in that country so they can use them as cheap labor. Versus in Israel, they not only are enforcing institutionalized discrimination against Palestinians, but they want them out. They want them completely out of the land of Palestine. So it takes apartheid to a much worse, horrific level than what we had even seen in South Africa. And again, the way that we can communicate with other people is rather than taking my statements or the statements of Noam Chomsky, take the statements of Benjamin Netanyahu directly, where he makes these open calls. You know, and they've been making these open calls for years. Go back to what they said in 2000. Go back to what they said in the 80s and the 70s and the 60s. Their plans for the area are vivid, and what they're asking for is ethnic cleansing and genocide and a country that is only for one community at the sacrifice of a whole other groups of people.
My guest is Rania Masri. I'm going to open the phones in about 5 minutes. I should mention that Benjamin Netanyahu made a statement that Israel lost a tremendous opportunity in 1989 during the world's concern and focused on the Tiananmen Square uprising in China, where they could have actually ethnically cleansed all the Arabs from Palestine and pushed them into Jordan. He said that publicly. He's also said publicly, or at a meeting in Israel, which was, you can see on YouTube, the United States is a country that's kind of easy to push around. And we see how he gets away with insulting John Kerry and Netanyahu, and President Obama. And then the other day he said America should not second-guess Israel. I mean, it's like this is the country that gives them the weapons, even though they have one of the highest economies in the world. And when we give them the weapons, there's no debate, there's no discussion in Congress about this. So it's. I mean, in 1989, a pro-Israel congressman told an Israeli pro-Israeli journalist at the New Republic that it's not out of affection for Israel that it gets $3 billion a year. It's because if you vote against it, you'll wake up the next morning with your opponent having $500,000 war chest to run against you. So how do you see this in terms of dealing with members of Congress? Do you see that as an important role?
It's a critical role, and again, I mean, there's no way that we can deal with members of Congress on this issue if we don't deal with the whole system of elections that we have in this country, which means we have to have financial election reform. It becomes critical. We have to find a way to overturn the latest Supreme Court ruling on this decision. We have to find a way to organize before the elections, to organize in the primaries. We have to find a way to strengthen the third party because, quite unfortunately, the Democrats and the Republicans are becoming so extraordinarily similar that we struggle to find a difference between them, be it on domestic or foreign policy issues. So we have a lot of work to do on this issue, and I hesitate to simply say, let's call our congressman or call our congresswoman on this issue. Yes, let's do that. I mean, I do that regularly, and I vent off my steam, but I don't think we should look upon contacting our congressional representatives as the answer, because it's not. It's one thing that we can do, but the answer is a long-term marathon struggle in which we in the United States have to truly figure out how do we build a democracy? How do we reclaim the democracy? These become the questions that we have to battle with if we actually want to change Congress and change the policies from our congressional representatives.
Well, we have a caller on the phone here, and we'll go to the first caller. Hello, you're on Takes on the World.
Oh, hi. My name's Mary. I'm calling from Willits. And who's pulling the strings? You know, what's the bottom line with our relationship with Israel? Why are we granting this this iron protection, which they say is only 5% effective against missiles? And where can the American people go along those money lines to support the Palestinians, because there's really physically apparently nothing else we can do but send money.
Yes. I mean, in terms of where we can go to send money, one of the organizations that I support very much in the United States is Middle East Children's Alliance.
Exactly.
MECA, M-E-C-A, Middle East Children's Alliance. They're solid, they're strong, they work on the ground, and they have very good politics. However, there is a lot that we can do. This is not a humanitarian crisis. I mean, and as you're very well aware of, you know, Palestine hasn't been hit by a hurricane or by a tsunami. So consequently, there is a great deal that we can do, and I need to stress this time and time again. BDS is one of the most powerful ways that we can impact public policy in this country. It is very, very powerful. This means we issue resolutions in our unions, in our churches, in our universities that call for divestment. We work on boycott. We work to cleanse our supermarkets, for example, from Israeli products. And we do this strategically. So I'm not asking, you know, we go into our supermarket and remove everything all at once, but you pick one product and you organize on that. So you pick Ahava, for example, you pick SodaStream, you pick anything that is winnable, and you build on that victory and you take it forward. It also means that we cease on the example of the Finnish foreign minister when he said almost 10 days ago that sanctions against Israel must be an option on the table. So now people are actually talking about sanctions. We have the Latin American governments that are almost united now in their stance against Israel. We cease on that energy. This is the time for us to be most effective against boycott, you know, on boycott issues against Israel. This is the particular time because this is when people's energies are up. And we've noticed after every Israeli attack on Gaza, which typically happens every 2 years, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement gets strengthened. So I agree with you very much. You know, I think that Congress is a long-term marathon struggle, but with regards to what we can do to support Palestinian liberation, it is more than simply giving aid. As important as aid is, and I do support people to give their money on this issue, we also really, really must organize effectively in this country.
Great, and our board is lit up here. We're going to go another call. Hello, you're on Takes on the World.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. So I don't think to most Americans it's a mystery anymore that the fact that Congress votes $3.1 billion to Israel, Israel turns around and spends that money on weapons that are made in every union in the United States, and then those companies give Congress money to make sure they're voted, that the people are voted back in. So how do we know what the circle is. How do we stop? That's my question.
Okay, Vanya?
How do we stop that circle means how do we liberate our Congress from corporations? And again, it's a multifaceted struggle. How do we make sure that corporations are no longer considered persons in this country? How do we make sure that the majority of people actually get a representative Congress? And it goes back to how do we build a democracy? So the efforts that are being made in this country to overturn the Supreme Court ruling, which has lifted the cap on financial aid contributions to people that run for elections, becomes a critical aspect that we look into. The same would be connecting it with veterans, connecting it with the military, because all so often when people say military, they actually think soldiers. And when people think soldiers, they think we have to support our men and women. Versus when we look at all the money that is being poured into the military-industrial complex, it's not being given to soldiers, it's being given to corporations. So again, it's a long-term battle on how do we rebuild a democracy in this country.
Great, and we have board is lit up. Another question. Hello, you're on the air. Takes on the World.
Hello, this is Ellen from South Coast Peace People. I wanted to clarify some things about Hamas. That Netanyahu has been lying, of course, about Hamas very badly. Hamas continued to observe its ceasefire with Israel until July 30th. When Israel bombed Hamas inside Gaza. It was the small parties, especially Islamic Jihad, who were shooting rockets into Israel after Hamas ceased to be the government of Gaza in June 2nd, after they formed the unity government. Then Hamas was no longer in charge, and the small parties began shooting. Now, an Israeli official, quoted in the Times of Israel, said that it was the smaller groups, such as Islamic Jihad, that are usually behind the rocket attacks, while Hamas squads generally attempted to thwart the rocket fire, which is what they did when they were the government of Gaza. And so Hamas was innocent, of kidnapping the three settler youths, which Netanyahu blamed them for. The police spokesperson in Jerusalem said, no, the people who did it had no contact with the Hamas leadership. They were a lone cell. Israeli officials even contradict Netanyahu's lies about Hamas. In this particular instance, and in fact, since 2008, Hamas has not violated the ceasefires with Israel. It's Israel that violates the ceasefires. Blames Hamas and goes and attacks.
That's good information. Maybe Rania would comment on that as well.
I completely agree with what the caller has said, but I want to take it to a second level, because all too often we get caught up in who launched the rockets and who launched those first. And most definitely it is the Israelis that have consistently violated the ceasefire accords. But take it a step further. The siege on Gaza is illegal. The occupation on Gaza is illegal. Therefore, even if Hamas, Islamic Jihad, any of the Palestinian resistance factions within Gaza did launch those rockets first, it would not be considered a provocation. It would be considered a retaliation against the siege, against the blockade, against the regular attacks by the Israeli Navy on Palestinian fishermen, against these regular violations of human rights and international law that the Israeli army and the Israeli government continue to practice against Palestinians in Gaza. When we put it into that aspect, into that narrative, we are allowed to step away from either apologizing or not apologizing for the rockets and putting it in this powerful context, which is, yes, we support the Palestinian resistance because Palestinians, as any population under occupation, have the legitimate and ethical and legal right to resist occupation by all means necessary, including armed resistance. And it is within that framework that we then could take the conversation forward. If the Israelis are so worried about rockets, if the U.S. population is so worried about these paltry, almost firecracker rockets that come out of Gaza, then the solution is very clear. End the occupation. End the siege, respect international law. That becomes the pathway to peace. And I think we can take the conversation that way much more forcefully so that we don't get caught up into who did what to whom when. Because they should never, never, never equate the violence of the oppressed with the violence of the oppressor.
Well, on that note, Rania, we have a full board lit up. We've had more calls today than in any of my other recent programs. I want to thank you so much for shedding light on the situation and telling people what can be done here, the alliances that need to be made in order to change the situation. Rania Masri, thanks so much for being our guest on Takes on the World, and I want to do it again very soon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.